This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering Gardner and the towns of Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Petersham, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchendon. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashburnham, Petersham, and Winchendon, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Gardner News, covering the week of July 29th through August 5th. This is Dave Russell reading with Alexandra Zapatis. Our first story, Narragansett budget vote avoids deeper cuts across district. This is written by Stephen Landry. By a margin of just 10 votes, residents of Templeton and Phillipston approved a $26.9 million fiscal 2027 budget for the Narragansett Regional School District, preserving several positions and programs that had been slated for elimination. The budget passed 277-267 during a special district-wide meeting held August 3rd in the Narragansett Middle School Auditorium. The approval spares four elementary teaching positions, two custodial jobs, and the district's MVP and Thrive programs from potential cuts. The vote came after roughly 2 hours of public comment and followed the defeat of three motions proposing lower amended budgets. "No one wins here tonight," said John Valentine of Templeton. "At the end of the day, it's all about affordability. Of course, we want for all our children and the school system, but we also want police, fire, first responders who actually save lives." Despite the budget's passage, district officials will still be forced to make a number of reductions. The approved spending plan eliminates four paraprofessional positions, a physical education teacher, an assistant superintendent position, and a principal position. Funding for classroom supplies and district software was also removed from the budget. The special district meeting was called after Phillipston voters rejected a $208,020 school budget override during a June 30th special election. Templeton voters had previously approved their share of the school budget, approximately $9.9 million, at the town's annual town meeting in May. Under state law and the district's regional agreement, both Templeton and Phillipston must approve the same school budget for it to take effect. Each community's assessment is based on its share of the district's student enrollment. Monday's vote ends months of uncertainty surrounding the district's fiscal 2027 spending plan and avoids even deeper cuts to staffing and student services across Narragansett Regional School District schools. Our next story, Gardner hosts free National Night Out community event. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. Families in the greater Gardner area are invited to attend the 13th annual National Night Out, a free community event aimed at fostering connections between residents, public safety officials, and local organizations. The event is scheduled for Thursday, August 6th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Gardner High School, 200 Catherine Street in Gardner, according to a community announcement. National Night Out is a nationwide initiative that promotes strong relationships between residents and law enforcement while encouraging safer neighborhoods. The Greater Gardner Celebration has become a popular tradition, offering activities and attractions for attendees of all ages. This year's event will feature a variety of free activities, including trackless train rides, go-karts, music and games, inflatable attractions, dunk tank, touch-a-truck displays, local vendors and community resources, free cookout, ice cream truck and popcorn, free raffles and giveaways, reptile and dog show, farm animals and petting zoo, and free haircuts. Organizers encourage families to attend and take advantage of the opportunity to meet local community partners, learn about available services, and enjoy an evening of entertainment. National Night Out is an opportunity for neighbors, families, public safety officials, and community organizations to come together and strengthen the connections that help make our communities safer and stronger, organizers said. The event is hosted by the Greater Gardner community with support from local partners. Again, it's the 13th Annual Greater Gardner National Night Out, Thursday, August 6th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Gardner High School, 200 Catherine Street in Gardner. It is free. For more information, visit the City of Gardner website. As I mentioned at the beginning of this story, it was created by Kimberly Green, with the assistance of artificial intelligence, or AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Now we turn to Gardner business. Tejeeva B's Treasure Chest brings local vendors to downtown Gardner. This is written by Stephen Landry, and this editor's note, the story has been updated to correct an inaccuracy. What started as a creative outlet during one of the most difficult periods of Tanya Boudreau's life is about to become a new downtown business. Boudreau, a Westminster resident with deep roots in Gardner, will open Tejeeva B's Treasure Chest at 47 Parker Street, and did open it on Sunday, August 2nd, adding a new gift and artisan marketplace to the city's growing downtown business community. A ribbon-cutting ceremony was scheduled for Wednesday morning. The shop will offer a mix of handcrafted goods, vintage items, home decor, plants and products from local artisans, all spread across four themed sections. Those themes, My Creations, Vintage and More, the Botanical Room, and Market Finds. For Boudreau, the opening represents far more than a new business venture. After losing her 27-year-old son Jason 7 years ago, she found comfort in creating handmade items, gradually turning a hobby into a passion and eventually a business. "That kind of became my passion," Boudreau said. "Instead of selling out of my house and in shops, I wanted more. I wanted my own shop." A longtime employee at the Colonial Hotel, where she had worked for 11 years, Boudreau began making jewelry before expanding into handcrafted gnomes, which quickly gained popularity. More recently, she shifted her creative focus toward home decor. "Last October, I decided to give home decor a try. And that really has become my passion," she said. "I still double in making jewelry, so it's a little bit of both." The opportunity to open a storefront arrived unexpectedly. Boudreau said she was driving through Gardner on her way to purchase soil for a memorial garden dedicated to her son when she noticed a sign outside the Parker Street building. Rather than continuing on with her errand, she turned toward the property and called the number listed on the sign. "I was just going to write the number down, and instead I called," she said. The call connected her with the building owner, and within a month, she had secured the space. "I didn't expect any of that to happen at all," she said. Now, after weeks of preparing the storefront, recruiting vendors, and organizing inventory, Boudreau is preparing to welcome customers through the door. The store's name, which is pronounced with a silent J, incorporates Boudreau's first initial, the first initial of her late son, and the name of her grandmother. The business already has approximately 13 vendors signed on, with room for more. Her goal is to create a shop where customers can find a wide variety of locally made products in one location. "I'm looking for a variety," she said. "That's what I want my store to be, a variety gift shop for customers of all different sorts." Visitors can expect to find everything from handcrafted jewelry, candles and soaps, to crocheted items, greeting cards, and decorative pieces for the home. Boudreau is also helping to add products such as locally produced honey and other specialty goods from area makers. Any vendors interested in learning more about the shop can contact Boudreau at 978-577-7343. In addition to shopping, customers will be able to take advantage of gift wrapping and shipping services, making the store a one-stop destination for gifts and special occasions. Boudreaux said she has been encouraged by the support she's received from neighboring businesses, including a welcoming visit from Lakin's Children's Fine Apparel shortly after she moved into the nearby space. She's also optimistic about the downtown location, despite concerns some shoppers may have about parking. The nearby public parking lot and established businesses in the area give her confidence that their customers will find their way to the store. While Boudreaux will operate the shop primarily on her own, she doesn't do it entirely alone. Her husband, Josh, has played a key role behind the scenes, helping install security systems, set up internet services, and manage the technical aspects of the business. "He's been a godsend," she said. As the opening day approached, Boudreaux, who has a 28-year-old son, Alex, who lives out of state, admits the emotions are mixed. Like many first-time business owners, she's feeling both excitement and uncertainty about the future. "I'm very scared. I'm not going to lie," she said with a laugh, "but I'm very excited." For Boudreaux, Tiva B's treasure chest is more than a retail store. It's the realization of a dream years in the making, a showcase for local artisans, and a chance to create something positive from a deeply personal journey. And beginning with that August 2nd opening, she's hoping the community will come through the doors and discover a little treasure of its own. We started off with Narragansett schools. Now we go to area schools as back-to-school countdown begins across Gardner area districts. This is written by Stephen Landry. Don't try to adjust your calendar. Those dates are correct. The end of another summer is rapidly approaching, which means most families are enjoying the last of their vacation days while still trying to schedule at least one more day or two at the beach. But it also means that as students make the most of their remaining vacation days, their parents will soon be shopping for back-to-school sales, searching for the best deals on clothes, book bags, pencils, laptops, and notebooks. Meanwhile, school officials and educators are neatening up their classrooms, preparing lesson plans, and looking forward to the next group of students taking their desks for the semester ahead. Here is a list of when the first day of school is for the six districts in the greater Gardner area. For Gardner Public Schools, the first day for grades 1 to 12 is Monday, August 31st. Kindergarten orientation for students with last names A through L will take place at Gardner Elementary School on Wednesday, August 26th, 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Orientation for kindergarten students with last names from M through Z will be held at the same time and place on the following day, Thursday, August 27th. The first day of kindergarten classes will be Tuesday, September 1st. A preschool open house for parents and students will be held at the Gardner Elementary School on Wednesday, September 9th from 5 to 6:30 p.m. An instrumental rental night will be held for grades 3 and 4 at GES on Wednesday, September 9th from 6 to 7 p.m. An open house for grades 1 and 2 will be hosted at the Gardner Elementary School on Thursday, September 10th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. The open house for grades 3 and 4 at GES will take place 2 weeks later on Thursday, September 24th from 6 to 7:30. An open house for Gardner High School and Gardner Academy will be held at GHS on Wednesday, September 23rd from 4 to 5 p.m. For Ashburnham-Westminster Regional School District, the first day for kindergartners is Tuesday, September 8th, with an orientation for kindergarten students on Tuesday, September 1st from 9 to 10 a.m. An orientation for Oakmont freshmen will be held on Friday, August 28th from 7:30 a.m. to noon. There'll be an open house for John R. Briggs Elementary School on Thursday, September 24th from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. and an open house at the Meeting House School on Thursday, October 1st from 5 to 6 p.m. For the Montachusett Regional Vocational Technical School, the first day of school at Monte Tech will be Monday, August 31st. Orientation for ninth graders will take place on Monday, August 24th and Tuesday, August 25th. Portraits will be taken at that event. Orientation for parents of new students will take place on Tuesday, August 25th. Orientation for new upperclassmen will take place on Thursday, August 27th. The first day of classes for students in the Narragansett District will be on Monday, August 31st. The first day of classes for kindergarten, Tuesday, September 1st. Pre-K screenings will take place on Monday, August 31st through Thursday, September 3rd. An orientation at Ice Cream Social for Grade 5 will be held at Narragansett Middle School from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, August 19th. For Quabbin Regional School District, first day for all students is Monday, August 31st. Winchendon Public Schools, the first day of classes for students in grades 1 through 12 in Winchendon is Thursday, August 27th. The first day for kindergarten students in the district is Wednesday, September 2nd. Pre-K students will begin the year on Thursday, September 10th. Orientation for preschool and kindergarten will be held on Thursday, August 27th at Memorial Elementary School from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. And a Welcome Back Snow Cone Social scheduled for Wednesday, August 25th from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. at Memorial Elementary School. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now Alexandra Zapantis joins us, and she has more Gardner news for you. Alexandra?
Thank you, Dave. Gardner area farmers markets offer fresh food as cyclospora concerns grow. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. If the cyclospora outbreak that is sickening people across the country is giving you pause on whether to order that salad or not, you can relax, at least a little bit. As of July 1st, there have only been 18 confirmed cases of cyclosporiasis in Massachusetts. A cyclosporiasis outbreak has spread to 9 states. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said July 24th, as the intestinal illness that causes weeks of severe and explosive diarrhea continues to sicken thousands of Americans, with case counts still climbing. The 9 states linked to the outbreak are Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. Cases have been reported in 41 states, the CDC said. However, the federal data lags state data for weeks. The agency is still investigating the illnesses unrelated to the multi-state outbreak. But if you're eyeing the produce aisle with a little more skepticism than usual, but still want to eat your greens, you may want to consider shopping for your produce at a local farmer's market. It's going to be fresher there, too. Here's when they operate. Thursday. The Orange Farmers Market is every Thursday from 3 to 6 p.m. at Butterfield Park, 100 East River Street, Orange. The Farmers Market also offers a kids' corner for the market dwellers who are parents of young children, with crafts, projects, and games for the kids. There will also be live music, and this year, Home Fruit Wines is a new vendor. A monthly farmers market is held at the Fitchburg Art Museum, 185 Elm Street, Fitchburg, on the first Thursday of the month from 3 to 5:30 p.m. through October 1st. Follow the farmers market Facebook page to stay updated on any changes to this season's schedule and vendors list. Friday. The Westminster Farmers Market is located on Academy Hill Road in Westminster and operates from 3 to 6 p.m. There are over 30 vendors selling locally produced goods and fresh produce, and have live music performed by local and regional musicians and bands. The last day is Friday, October 16th. To get updates on the Westminster Farmers Market, follow their Facebook page. Saturday. The Winchington Farmers Market is every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The market is operating from a new location for 2026 at the Hub in the Winchington CAC Center, 5 Summer Drive. This market will be open until late October. Follow the Farmers Market Facebook page to stay updated on any changes to this season's schedule and vendors list. The Leominster Farmers Market, located at Monument Square in downtown Leominster, has 3 more outdoor markets scheduled for 2026, and they are always the first Saturday of the month, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Follow the Leominster Market on Facebook to stay updated on date changes and the lists of vendors. The City of Gardner's monthly seasonal farmers market has 4 remaining dates, with the next being Saturday, August 15th. Located at 62 Waterford Street, the market operates from 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. There will be a market each month until November 21st. To keep yourself updated on this farmer market, follow its Facebook page. Diane Zhang, Stephen J. Beard, Ramon Padilla, and John Heasley, all of USA Today, contributed to this report. Trump asks Supreme Court help on mail-in ballots. How would it affect Massachusetts? This is by Margie Cullen for the USA Today Network, New England. President Donald Trump is seeking to tighten national rules on mail-in ballots in a move that could impact Massachusetts's upcoming midterm elections. On July 27th, the Trump administration filed an emergency appeal asking the Supreme Court to let the administration carry out an executive order that seeks to create a federal list of eligible voters and limit delivery of mail ballots only to people on that list after lower courts in Boston blocked it in nearly half the country. If Trump's executive order is allowed to proceed, it has the potential to affect Massachusetts elections, in which many people vote by mail. In the 2024 presidential election, 34.2% of ballots in Massachusetts were cast by mail. In Massachusetts, no excuse early voting by mail is available for most elections, including state elections and primaries, presidential primaries, and most local elections. Residents can request vote-by-mail ballots online, by mail, or by email or fax. Trump, who has voted by mail himself, contends absentee ballots are often fraudulent. However, Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell said that vote-by-mail is secure and functioning well in Massachusetts with no evidence of widespread fraud. Let's call this what it is. It's an attack on Americans' constitutional right to vote, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey said in a post on social media about the appeal July 27th. Vote-by-mail works. In Massachusetts, our elections are safe, secure, and accessible, and I'll do everything in my power to make sure they stay that way. Under the Constitution, states are assigned the role of administering federal elections. But Trump has called for greater federal control since losing his 2020 re-election campaign, also calling for requiring voters to provide identification at polling places and proof of citizenship when registering. He's continued to push the false claim that he lost because of widespread voter fraud. The latest fight over rules for absentee ballots comes just ahead of the midterm elections, which will determine which party controls Congress. Nearly 30% of voters cast a ballot by mail in the 2024 elections, and Democrats are more likely than Republicans to vote by mail. What the courts have already said about Trump's mail-in ballots order. In June, a federal judge in Boston said key parts of that executive order were unconstitutional, ruling that those components can't be enforced this year in the 23 states that are challenging the order, including Massachusetts. And in July, an appeals court rejected the administration's argument that the state's lawsuit was premature because the executive order has not been fully implemented. The Boston-based First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the changes are already straining states and would sow confusion and threaten disenfranchisement of many eligible voters if allowed to go into effect for the November elections. But the Justice Department told the Supreme Court that pausing Trump's executive order was wrong because the lower court preemptively decided that whatever the agencies may choose to do will necessarily be unlawful, the government's lawyers wrote. The Supreme Court asked the states challenging the order to respond to the administration's appeal by August 3rd. Contributing, Maureen Grope. Convicted murderer accused of killing cellmate in Gardner Prison. This is by Brad Petrushin with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. In Worcester, a Springfield man convicted of murder in 2009 is nearing trial in Worcester Superior Court on previously unreported allegations of murdering his cellmate in a medium-security Gardner prison 4 years ago. Amado Marmal, who admitted in 2009 to stabbing a man to death while trying to rob him of food, is accused of murdering Pedro Torres at the North Central Correctional Institution in Gardner on February 11, 2022. Blacked out and killed my roommate. Authorities allege Marmal despondently told senior prison staff around 11 a.m. that day, prompting them to confirm that Torres was unresponsive. Marmal, who is slated for trial in September, was indicted in June 2022. However, it does not appear authorities ever publicly announced the charges or Torres's death. Court documents indicate Marmal, who is serving a life sentence with parole eligibility after 15 years on a second-degree murder plea, was transferred to the Gardner prison from the state's maximum security prison a year before the killing. The Department of Correction referred a request for comment to Worcester County District Attorney Joseph D. Early's office, which declined to comment, citing its policy of not speaking about open cases due to professional rules of conduct. Marmal was 30 when he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in 2009 in the 2005 stabbing death of Richard G. Dellaguastina. According to Mass Live, authorities had alleged that Marmal, then homeless, stabbed Dellaguastina, 53, 9 times and slashed his face while robbing him of frozen food and other items inside his Springfield apartment. Court records indicate Marmal was in 2022 one of about 20% of inmates at the Gardner State Prison serving life sentences as inmates, a superior court judge wrote, are moved around the prison system based on their ability to live and function. The judge, William J. Ritter, denied an attempt by Marmal to make incriminating statements he gave to prison staff inadmissible in court. According to Ritter's 2025 ruling, Marmal did not have any serious behavioral problems at Gardner, which the judge noted was described as being similar to a college campus surrounded by a fence. Inmates can move freely about the prison, Ritter said, and while some cells exist, inmates are housed in a dormitory-style setting. Ritter said Marmal, the day of the killing, approached the prison superintendent and another staffer outside near a loading dock and told them he messed up, using an expletive. Ritter said after Marmal refused to elaborate, the administrator suggested going inside, where Marmal allegedly, tearfully, told them he'd blacked out and killed his roommate. Staff quickly confirmed Torres was unresponsive. The exact manner of death was not clear from Ritter's ruling, in two related court briefs. Authorities allege Marmol declined to speak about the death with state police, though he did, after being placed in a holding cell, allegedly make incriminating statements to or around a correction officer. What do they get for murder? 10 years in the DDU? Marmol allegedly said, referencing a departmental disciplinary unit, followed later by, "This thing, who cares? I did it before and will probably do it again." Marmol's lawyer tried to get all the statements thrown out of court, arguing Marmol had mental health issues and medication noncompliance, and noting he was not read his Miranda rights before he reportedly confessed to blacking out and killing Torres. Ritter let the confession stand, agreeing with prosecutors that Marmol wasn't being investigated for anything at the time he made it, and thus didn't need to be read his rights. Ritter also left admissible the later statements Marmol allegedly made in the holding cell, ruling they were spontaneously made, not prompted. Marmol, whose court records indicate has a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, does not plan to use insanity or diminish mental health as his defense, his lawyer, Lewis M. Badway, wrote in recent filings. Badway did not immediately respond to an email offering comment. On July 28th, Ritter set a trial date for Marmol of September 8th. And now, back over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Alexandra. Now we continue with this story. Register now for Hubbardston's annual Dinghy Dash on August 22nd. It's written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. The annual Dinghy Dash is returning to Brigham Pond in Hubbardston on August 22nd, bringing with it cardboard boats, friendly competition, and laughs. According to a community announcement, the event will kick off at 10 a.m. and feature boats made entirely from cardboard and duct tape. Participants of all ages and experience levels are invited to join the race. Registration costs are $20 per boat, with proceeds going to the Hubbardston Celebration Committee's Special Events Fund, which supports future community events. The regatta includes three competition categories: single-occupant vessel youth, that's under 18, single-occupant vessel adult, ages 18 and older, and group vessel, 2 to 4 people per vessel. Prizes will be awarded in each division, with first-place winners receiving a $150 gift card and second-place finishers earning a $100 gift card. Additional awards will recognize Best Sink, Most Creative Vessel, and Extended Voyage achievements. Organizers encourage residents, families, friends, businesses, and community groups to participate in this summer tradition. The event not only promotes creativity and teamwork, but also helps raise funds for local programming, according to the announcement. Registration entries are due by August 17th. Official rules and regulations are available through event organizers. For more information, you can email hubbardston250@gmail.com. Now we turn to other entertainment in the community. Where to see live music this summer in Greater Gardner? This is written by Stephen Landry. There will be plenty of music in the air across Greater Gardner this month. Several venues have announced their outdoor concert schedules, and there will be something for just about everyone who loves live music. Here are some of the shows coming up this month. The popular summer concert series at Monument Park continues on Saturday, August 8th, with Mr. Strickland, a local band named after the principal in Back to the Future. They'll be hoping that there are no slackers like Marty McFly in the crowd when they perform classic rock tunes from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. The question for the next performance: who can go the distance? We'll find out when The Long Run, led by local favorite Dan Kerouac, brings the music of the Eagles to the park on Saturday, August 15th. The Monument Park crowd will twist and shout the night away when Forever Fab, billed as New England's premier Beatles tribute band, bring their mop tops to the stage on Saturday, August 22nd. The Random Band will close out the season on Saturday, August 29th. The show on August 8th will run from 6 to 8 p.m., and the final three performances on the 15th, 22nd, and 29th will run from 5 to 7 p.m. Rain dates for most shows will be the following Sunday. There are also continuing performances at Candlelight Cafe in Templeton. Burning Sky, the popular Bad Company tribute band, will rock the stage on Saturday, August 8th, 7 to 9 p.m. Tickets for the show are $10 pre-sale, $15 at the door. The Ben Cody Band will entertain the Candlelight crowd on Saturday, August 22nd. Tickets for the show, which will go from 6 to 9 p.m., are $10 pre-sale and $15 at the door. Kid Hurricane, a Worcester-based classic rock cover band, will perform a free show from 7 to 10 p.m. on Friday, August 28th. Petty Larceny, the Tom Petty tribute act, will be Running Down a Dream on Saturday, August 29th. Tickets for the show, which will go from 6 to 9 p.m., are $10 pre-sale and $15 at the door. It will be a Meathead's Delight on Saturday, September 5th, when the Candlelight Cafe presents A Night of Led Zeppelin and From Sabbath, a Black Sabbath tribute band. Tickets for the show, which will go from 6 to 10:30 p.m., are $15 pre-sale, $20 at the door. And the New England-based Into the Floyd tribute band will close out the season with an impressive performance that recreates Pink Floyd's legendary music, lighting, and visuals. That will be on Saturday, September 12th. Tickets for the show, which will go from 6 to 9 p.m., are $15 pre-sale, $20 at the door. All shows at the Candlelight Cafe are weather permitting. Lawn chairs are welcome. Our next story, Westminster residents graduate from Fire Academy. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. Cassidy Cox and Ryan Provencial, both from Westminster, recently graduated from the Massachusetts Firefighter Academy's Call Volunteer Recruit Firefighter Training Program, according to a community announcement. The class graduated at the Department of Fire Services Springfield campus and prepares call and volunteer firefighters for the challenges of emergency response in suburban and rural communities. The 240-hour program is designed for those who serve part-time or on-call, offering evening and weekend classes to accommodate work and family schedules. Graduates receive training in fire suppression, search and rescue, hazardous materials response, and more. Recruits learned how to handle a variety of emergencies, from house fires to chemical spills and ice rescues. The curriculum includes classroom instruction, physical fitness training, and live fire exercises under controlled conditions. Massachusetts Firefighting Academy instructors draw on decades of experience in the fire service to train new recruits, said MFA Recruit Program Coordinator Dean Babineau, that according to the announcement. Through consistent classroom instruction and practical exercises, these graduates have developed the tools they'll need to protect themselves, their communities, and each other. State Fire Marshal John M. Devine said, according to the announcement, "Massachusetts firefighters are on the front line protecting their communities every day, and these graduates are needed now more than ever. The hundreds of hours of foundational training they've received on nights and weekends will provide them with the physical, mental, and technical skills to perform their jobs effectively and safely." The Call Volunteer Firefighter Recruit Training Program delivers a standard recruit training curriculum on nights and weekends to accommodate the schedules of firefighters in suburban and rural areas, according to the announcement. The Massachusetts Firefighting Academy has offered the CALL volunteer training program since 2003. More than 3,000 recruits have graduated from the program, which meets national standards for firefighter qualifications. Graduates may also seek certification as Firefighter 1 and 2 and Hazardous Materials Operational Level Responder. This story, Tax-Free Weekend, is almost here in Massachusetts. Ready for some summer shopping? It's almost time for every shopper's favorite holiday in Massachusetts, Tax-Free Weekend. Held this year on Saturday, August 8th and Sunday, August 9th, the annual weekend tax holiday exempts most personal purchases made in Massachusetts from the state sales tax of 6.25%. The tax exemptions apply to most retail items under $2,500, but with some restrictions. All open Massachusetts businesses that make taxable sales are required to take part in the sales tax holiday, August 8th and 9th. If any retailer does charge sales tax, the individual business is responsible to give a refund. The most important thing to remember is that the sales tax exemption only applies to personal purchases. That means items purchased for a business are still taxable. According to the Massachusetts Department of Revenue website, the following retail items are excluded from the sales tax holiday: meals, motor vehicles, motorboats, telecommunications services, gas, steam, electricity, tobacco products, marijuana and related products, alcoholic beverages, any single item over $2,500, any single clothing item over $175. For items that exceed $2,500, the entire amount of the purchase after the first $175 will be taxable. For clothing items over $175, only the exceeding amount is subject to tax. Layaway items do not qualify for the sales tax holiday. And items bought throughout the tax-free weekend can be arranged for delivery after the holiday ends. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now, with the final segment of the Gardner News, here's Alexandra.
Thank you again, Dave. Fitchburg man wanted on arson charge in Myrtle Avenue house blaze. This is by Brad Petrushin with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. A Fitchburg man has been wanted for arson since June regarding one of three fires authorities allege were intentionally set there in February. Mark Alicia, 39, was indicted by a Worcester County grand jury June 18th on an arson charge in relation to a February 18th blaze at 164 Myrtle Ave that displaced seven people, injuring one of them. Court records show a judge issued an arrest warrant for Alicia June 18th at the request of District Attorney Joseph DiEarly Jr.'s office, which listed his address as being on Payson Street, about a mile from the fire. Fitchburg police are working closely with federal and state law enforcement to find Alicia, Police Chief Stephen D. Giannani told the Telegram and Gazette Thursday, July 30th. Alicia was also indicted on charges of stealing a motor vehicle and stealing more than $1,200 worth of electronics in Fitchburg the same day of the fire. Alicia allegedly stole both the vehicle and electronics from a person whose address or connection to 164 Myrtle Ave, if any, was not made clear from the indictments. Indictments are threadbare court documents that do not contain as much detail as cases filed in lower courts. Early's office, citing its practice for not commenting on pending cases, declined to comment July 30th. The Myrtle Avenue fire was one of three that Fitchburg firefighters battled between February 14th and February 18th that local and state officials believed to be arson. The other two fires took place February 14th and 15th in a large apartment building with entrances at 43 Blossom Street and 40 Day Street. They were successfully extinguished by firefighters before they could spread. Fire Marshal John M. Devine offered a reward of up to $5,000 in February for information regarding the fires, all of which he said appeared to have been set intentionally. Devine said at the time that he did not believe the Myrtle Avenue fire to be connected to the other two fires, and Giannini confirmed July 30th authorities continue to hold that view. Devine in February said authorities had not yet determined whether the two other fires were related to each other, but noted they always consider a link when suspicious fires are reported in close proximity. Devine's office declined to answer questions July 30th about any updates to the investigation, referring comment to early. Giannini told the Telegram and Gazette July 30th that none of the tips authorities have received so far have assisted them in identifying any suspects in the two other fires. Anyone with information on the fires can call the Arson Watch Reward Program at 800-682-9229. We have not received any recent tips, Giannini said. The person hurt in the Myrtle Avenue blaze suffered non-life-threatening injuries, authorities have said. Alicia's criminal records in Lower Worcester County courts do not appear substantial. They include a 2010 drug conviction in Leominster and a dismissed charge of disorderly conduct in Fitchburg from 2009. Court records indicate a woman obtained a restraining order against Alicia in Leominster District Court in November 2025. He was ordered to stay away from her and surrender any firearms. Westminster 40B plan shifts access to Bacon Street amid concerns. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. Seeking a compromise, Normandine Group, LLC, has proposed a major redesign of its downtown Westminster 40B project to address concerns of using dead-end Adams Street as the apartment complex's main access point. On Tuesday, July 28th, the Westminster Zoning Board of Appeals continued the public meeting regarding the 48-unit affordable housing project application from the developer, Normandin Group. During the meeting, McCarty Engineering, the consultant hired by Normandin Group, presented changes made following a third-party peer review by Stephen Booley, a senior project manager at Tetra Tech. The engineers presented a new building plan in which the access point to the apartment complex would not be through the narrow, 18-foot-wide dead-end Adams Street into Main Street, but would be through Bacon Street onto Main Street. Redesign is not the final plan. Mark O'Hagan, one of the consultants assisting with the application process, said the plan to relocate the structure on the land and the main entrance is just an idea suggested by the Zoning Board of Appeals. The goal is to work with the community, come up with a plan that makes the most sense, he said. Having alternatives, always a good thing from a planning and design perspective. So there are options here, and that's the main thing that we're trying to convey. Residents continue to be skeptical. Residents who attended the meeting said they still believe this isn't the best location for the 48-unit complex, even if the entrance location is changed. Many brought the concern about doing follow-up traffic in stormwater studies. Westminster homeowner Josh Karen at 22 Bacon Street said that regardless of the changes to the building plan, many like him don't want to see this project being built, and it's currently feeling like residents don't have a choice. It's not even really our decision, candidly, he said. There's people in this room against this project. How is the town protecting the people in the community? We don't want it. The 40B project meeting is scheduled to continue on Tuesday, August 18th at 6 p.m. in the Westminster Senior Center, but the date is subject to change. What's next for KRO's owners after upcoming closing? This is by Stephen Landry with the Gardner News. For more than 6 years, KRO's on the Common has been more than just a place to grab breakfast or lunch. It has been where families gathered for milestone celebrations, where friends met over coffee, and where regular customers became part of the restaurant's extended family. On Saturday, August 15th, owners Karen Osterberg and Terry Fougere will serve their final meals before closing the doors of the longtime Templeton restaurant for good. The decision was not an easy one. A combination of financial pressures, staffing challenges, and the lingering effects of the COVID-19 pandemic ultimately made continuing the business unsustainable, Osterberg said. We had always hoped to own and operate the restaurant for 10 years before retiring, she said. Unfortunately, a variety of factors changed that. Among those factors were rising costs for food, insurance, and everyday supplies, along with the staffing difficulties that have challenged restaurants across the region in recent years. Restaurant was briefly on the market. Earlier this year, the couple put the property on the market, but the listing was later withdrawn. The property is not currently listed for sale, and we are still living in the apartment upstairs, Osterberg said. I would love to see a younger person purchase the property someday and continue some sort of community-driven business. That community focus has been at the heart of KRO's since the day it opened. Located in the center of town, the restaurant quickly became a gathering place for residents from Templeton and surrounding communities, hosting everything from casual meals to private celebrations. Some of Osterberg's favorite memories involve helping customers mark important moments in their lives. Guests that have hosted their private events here or come for a meal because it's a special occasion, she said, the staff and I truly enjoy being part of that experience. Knowing that a guest has put us in charge of their event is a wonderful feeling. Owners have plans for the future. While the restaurant's final chapter is approaching, Osterberg and Fougere are already thinking about what comes next. First on the agenda may be a well-earned getaway. Maybe a little vacation in Tennessee to visit our best friends, Osterberg said. Then Terry and I will be looking for jobs. Still, stepping away from the restaurant business means leaving behind a routine that has shaped much of their lives over the past 6 years. For Osterberg, one of the hardest parts of closing will be missing the customers and relatives who became a regular part of each week. I will miss seeing my extended family every week, she said. My aunts, uncles, and cousins come in. We sit, swap stories, hug, etc. My Thursdays won't be the same without my weekly hug from my Uncle Joe. Not everything about restaurant ownership will be missed, however. Asked what she won't miss, Osterberg answered without hesitation. Baking, she said with a laugh. I do not enjoy baking at all. Although the couple currently has no plans to continue catering or host special events after the restaurant closes, Osterberg admitted it will be difficult seeing the space sit empty. As of right now, we do not, she said, when asked about future restaurant-related ventures. Although the thought of having such a beautiful and unique space sitting empty is heartbreaking. I love to entertain, and the restaurant space is a perfect setting for events. As the final days count down, Osterberg's focus remains on gratitude. Before KRO's on the Common serves its last meal, she wants customers to know how much their support has meant to her, Fougere, and the staff. A huge thank you, she said. Thank you for supporting us from the very beginning. Thank you for the laughter, the stories, the friendships, and the loyalty. For many in Templeton, the closing of KRO's on the Common marks the end of an era. For Osterberg and Fougere, it is a bittersweet farewell to a business they built, a community they helped foster, and countless memories that will remain long after the lights are turned off for the final time. Act fast to nab free school supplies at Gardner Back to School Party. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. The summer season is coming to an end, and the start of the school year is just weeks away. Families are gearing up to check off those back-to-school supply lists. For some parents, however, rising prices and everyday expenses can make it difficult to afford everything their children need. To help, several local and regional organizations are hosting backpack and school supply drives, as well as community events that often include free food, games, and activities to mark the end of summer break. Here's a roundup of programs and events in the greater Gardner area offering free school supplies to families in need. Gardner Family Resource Center. The Gardner Family Resource Center at 205 School Street in Gardner is hosting its annual back-to-school party for K-12 children on Friday, August 14th, between noon and 2 p.m. The celebration will give backpacks with school supplies to the first 48 kids. While registration is not required, Connor Collins, the administrative assistant at the Resource Center, said they prefer that people email or call in advance so they know how many people plan to attend. Call the Family Resource Center staff at 978-730-1275 or email Collins at connor.collins@csoinc.org. Backpack distribution in Athol. This year, the North Quabbin Patch Parents Council and Valuing Our Children Family Center will host backpack distributions on 2 days at two locations. The first day is for students who are not in the Athol-Royalston Regional School District. On Tuesday, August 19th, the event will take place between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m., and again from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at 109 Lumber Street in Athol. The next day, Wednesday, August 20th, from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., is only for ARRSD families at Fish Park. Pre-registration is encouraged. For information, call 978-249-5070. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Alexandra Zapantis. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Noir. I'm Private Eye Michael Stein. Every good investigator knows to stay vigilant for suspicious behavior. But a call from my old friend Cora reminded me that there's often more to a bird than meets the eye.
Michael, I just found the strangest bird. He looked like a crow, but sounded all wrong.
That does seem odd, Cora. Could he be a common raven? They look like giant crows that sound deep and croaky.
No, his calls were more short and nasal. I even said to him, "What, you got a cold or something?" And that bird called back to me saying, "Uh-uh." I mean, the whole thing seems fishy to me.
Fishy is right, but not for the reason you think. In most of the U.S., the American crow is the only crow in town. That's the caw you're probably used to. But on the Atlantic coast, and parts of the Midwest too, the fish crow is a common city bird. The two species look the same, but the fish crow's nasal caw is unmistakable.
Huh? I had no idea there were two kinds of crows.
Actually, there are more than 30 species worldwide.
Okay, wise guy. I'll drop you a line if any of them come cawing.
Yep, another case closed. For Bird Noir, I'm Private Eye Michael Stein.